This is talking with Professor Swarup at Cambridge on 17th August 76. Well, can you tell me what your background was? Was it physics?
Yes, I had master's in physics, and then I was working at the National Physical Laboratory in Delhi for a few years.
Right.
And under the Colombo plan, there was an opportunity to go abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other opportunities, but from the Australian Journal of Physics, radio astronomy seemed a very exciting possibility. I had no background of astronomy. So, 53, I went to Australia.
Right. In which group?
CSIRO Radio Astronomy. And Paulsy, who was in charge of my training up there, he advised me for the first 1 year to work with each of the groups, 3 months with Mills' group, 3 months with Weil, 3 months with Christensen.
I see.
And 3 months at Depto with Stanley and Bolton.
Yes.
And reading papers as well as instrumental development, because I was concerned trying to set up things back in India.
Right.
Working in this laboratory.
You mean that was your goal, was to go back to India and set up radio astronomy there?
Very clear. Well, I mean, to do something.
To do something.
I was trying, before I went to Australia, I was trying to set up paramagnetic resonance of a paper, 1948, Galileo.
I see.
K.S. Krishnan was the discoverer of paramagnetic resonance. 1935, who was the director of this laboratory.
I see.
And I remember his telling me that, well, if we can have set up, we can discover so many organic molecules, for example. This was well before they were discovered across the world.
Right.
And I was trying to set up, and I knew this, that the secret is to, at that era of the time, for a physicist to learn, at least in India, techniques to how to do things.
Right.
You couldn't get anybody else to do it in India, so you have to do it yourself. So I took interest in Australia with this aim, in the instrumental developments.
I see.
And second year, Christensen had gone to France, and I converted his old 32 six-element informator to work at 600 MHz. And that made me even more interested in that sort of...
The original frequency was...
It's 1420.
1420. You converted it
to 600 MHz, or 500,
right.
I don't remember now.
500, yes, 60 centimeters, right.
Yes, and then I went back to India, got a little frustrated.
When did you go back?
55.
Well, let me just talk about that. You had a couple of publications.
Yes, in Australia.
In Monthly Notices and Observatory about...
Australian Journal of Physics and Observatory, yes.
Right, in which you say that you did find limb brightening.
Yes, I
did. Which was a controversy. Yes.
It was a great controversy. Cambridge people said that there was no limb brightening. And just reading the literature, this occurred to me that, well, that's a very interesting thing. And so I mentioned Paulsy. He said, fine, are you willing to change the instrument to a different frequency? I said, yes, it's
right.
A good thing to do. So I did that.
Now, this was a similar frequency to what had been used in Cambridge?
Yes, very much similar.
And I have here that it agreed with the results of O'Brien, but he was from Cambridge.
No, it disagreed with the results of O'Brien.
It disagreed? But you said...
Martin and O'Brien, yes. There was evidence of limb brightening which disagreed with the earlier results from Cambridge.
I see, it disagreed with all of them, you're saying.
Yes,
I see.
And
Stanier also.
Yes, there were two papers from there.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry, I've forgotten exactly that. I must check back on that.
Well,
I do know
the abstract said that it agreed with O'Brien, but it disagreed with Stanier.
Okay, could be. I'm sorry, I've forgotten that.
But then your Australian Journal of Physics paper.
Yes, yes. Okay.
Well, that was similar to the first one.
This abstract said this must be correct. So then I went back to India, and actually these dishes were then sent to India.
I was
planning to set them up in India.
I see.
But the progress was very slow, so I went to the United States to work with Ellen Maxwell, as you know.
And when was that now?
56.
You went to the U.S.?
USA.
Right.
To work with Maxwell at Fort Davis.
And this had just been set up, Fort Davis? Was it?
Fort Davis had just been set up, so it was very interesting.
Right.
Just for a few months. And the dynamic spectrum I had seen it working at CERN with Paul Weil in Australia. So it really seemed most exciting. And there within a few months I found these U-bursts, as you know.
Right. And that was the discovery of them. No one had found those before.
Yes, right.
Was the Maxwell's... Well, who made the spectrograph? Did Maxwell make it?
The spectrograph was made by the Airborne Instruments Laboratory in New York.
And was it based on Weil's design?
No. It was AIL's design.
I see.
And Weil had lower frequencies, 42, some 240 megahertz. This was aiming at higher frequencies, 100 to 600 megahertz, because around 200, 300 megahertz is where we change from chromospheric layer to corona.
Ah, yes.
And the transition layer seemed most interesting.
Is that what enabled you to find the U-burst, because you had a higher frequency? Or?
No, I think it's just there was more sensitivity.
I see.
More dynamic range of the instrument. And I'm surprised why I did not see them earlier.
Yeah.
They came clear right, as I started looking at the records, just systematically analyzing. First I thought it's the off the scope, some curvature there.
Yeah.
But then it was very clear. Maxwell actually at that time was in New Zealand when I seen that.
I see.
And so that was very interesting. But then, you see, as I told you, my background and that few years in the National Physical Laboratory in early 50s somehow made an impact on me, that lack of being able to do yourself in Australia, where you could see that these people could build very simply new instruments and there were new discoveries.
Right.
And so after 6 months at Fort Davis, I published, and I had good background in physics. But it was very interesting that there was a strong background here, but very hollow elsewhere because of the poor education in India. So I decided to go graduate work.
I see.
And Sam Goldstein was probably more instrumental for my going to Stanford than anything else.
I see.
He was also working there. And actually I had a graduate assistantship at Harvard, Caltech and Stanford.
You mean you had the offers from
those
places?
Assistantship, yes.
But you chose Stanford.
Well, I wrote to Kauzi just sending one of my papers for publication of Australian casually mentioning that I have these and I have to decide.
Right.
And he promptly wrote back a short letter saying, well, it's a very difficult choice to make, but if you want to become an astrophysicist, Harvard is a place. You know, at Harvard you will become a good astrophysicist, Caltech will have good background, physics, astrophysics. But if you want to go back to India, my advice will be to go to Stanford.
To learn techniques.
Because the electronics is the key. He wrote science.
Right. Okay, thank you. Well, we'll continue.
And, as you know, I participated in the construction of the Stanford Cross.
Right.
Bracewell.
And was this Bracewell's idea mainly? Basically,
oh, yes. Bracewell had been constructing this already.
I see.
And so I helped him join it, helped in part of graduate student. Apart from my interest in solar radio astronomy, I did what is known now as a Swarup and Yang method for phase measurement of long transmission lines, which is used in all the radio telescopes that I know.
Ah, yes. And you wrote an article about that.
That's right. It's used in all the radio telescopes large for...
This was using gas discharge tubes.
Well, that's what I did, but people use diodes, they use various modifications. It is still used in most millimeter wave interferometers of all kinds for initial setting up, of course, Fermi calibrations by sources. And then I did work on quiet sun, slowly varying component. There was a gyro resonance model of slowly varying component by Kakinuma and myself in 61.
What was that name?
Kakinuma.
Kakinuma,
yes.
Okay.
Which is what explained all the features of the slowly varying component, and it's quite well accepted, this model. In fact, we made some predictions. Recently, Ratan 600, the new radio telescope by Parisky.
Oh, yes.
They've been observing, and many of the predictions are all right. So
I
they're saying, oh, well, it looks like the other
15 years afterwards.
Well, of course, we showed it from the data at that time, but they are now looking finer features.
Right, right.
And even in the finer features, is well confirmed.
So what about these papers with Partha Sarathy? Is it
that's the early papers in the... 1958. Australian work, 53-55. Well, paper probably came a little later.
Oh, I see, that's right. These were, but also in 58. In
yes, but it's the continuation of the work during that time.
I see.
In Australia at 60 centimeters.
Was that another Indian?
Yes, right.
In
he's in Alaska now. Yes, he's another Indian. Very interesting character. One of the most interesting characters I've met in my life. And
but not in radio astronomy.
Well, he's moved to ionosphere.
Right. Right.
Does some occasional, you know, the spacecraft, radio astronomy kind of thing. He's done some of that kind.
Now, the purpose of the Stanford Cross
was to make the maps, two-dimensional maps of the radio sun.
Right.
One map every day. So I produced many hundred radio maps of the sun.
Basically for monitoring them.
Yes, to see the slowly varying component, their height, the quiet sun, separating the background component, to see what causes the sunspot active regions, to study the active regions, the relation, what sort of brightness temperature do they have,
right, the
what's the relationship between some spots in radio emission. And this is what led to the gyro resonance model, because there were some odd things there. We did some polarization measurement also, so some very interesting. Well, it was, till that time it was accepted, it's all thermal emission, people more or less take it for granted.
Yes.
But we just started making more accurate measurements, which changed the whole picture, thing which was very well established, seemed to be established.
In the mid-50s?
Yes, in mid-50s. Suddenly got thrown out with better data. This, okay. That is clear to me from early years in radio astronomy in Australia, that rather than stopping and making very great detailed interpretation,
there
is still a great thrust of the accurate experimental data. I think this, in my own opinion, this situation stayed till at least mid-60s or late-60s.
In solar work?
In extragalactic, solar, everything. See, I mean, Ryle, for example, also just went and built better and better instruments, of course, while making interpretations, what they can, and some of the group, some of the people in the group did. But if you see the main thrust of many of the groups, at least till early 60s, was in developing better.
That's right. There were so many discoveries once you've gotten an instrument.
Yes, that's right, and that seemed very clear.
And do you think it's different now?
I think, see, as far as the discoveries are concerned, certainly they may be still building a big new instrument, you still find new discoveries. But the existing instruments give you so much data, there's no doubt you can do very good physics. But it was a little doubtful to my mind. You could do physics, but then there's so much experimental uncertainty. As a radio astronomer, you publish a paper, you know yourself what sort of uncertainties are there in your data.
Right.
And it seemed clear that if you have a better picture, you'll start seeing. It's like a blind man, you know.
Yes.
There's a phrase in India, there's this, I forget the exact detail, the way it goes, but there are three blind men, and they broke an elephant, and one touched the trunk, you probably know that.
Yes.
They say elephant is like that, and they touched the leg, and said elephant is like that. So that was sort of the situation in some parts of radio astronomy. Of course, Burbridge in 58 paper, when he worked out the minimum energy arguments.
For radio sources,
yes,
right?
Yes, Kardashev paper 61.
Now, when you were working on the sun in the late 50s, were you aware of all these other things that were going on at the same time?
Yes, because at that time you could know the whole radio astronomy.
Oh, yes.
So I knew everything. I mean, I knew what...
Yeah. Did you go to the Paris Symposium?
No, I did not go there because I was at that time graduate student at Stanford.
Oh, yes.
So I had become, from Harvard, I was a research associate, full-time worker there. But then I became to Stanford, so I had not gone there. But I was aware what happened there.
Now, let me ask about the building of the... Stanford Cross. Were there any great difficulties in building it, or since it had been done before, was it pretty straightforward?
No, because this was a centimeter wavelength. Christensen had built it at longer wavelengths, and so there were problems of phasing. There were great problems about phasing.
That's why you came up with this,
this idea.
No,
and, while it was not quite that, you see that the mechanical engineer had made some mistakes in the placement of the antennas. And everybody took for those granted, and I phased it. Used to take months to phase the array, and I did this twice. And when the question came third time, I said, I'm not going to do the conventional way. I had worked with Mills, and I knew how the phasing of Mills cross has been done, and knew the phasing of how Christensen did it. They were all built in formators.
Right.
And I had it to Stanford, new microwaves, suddenly with Ginston. I was in the electrical engineering department there. So, just the knowledge from elsewhere and the new understanding of the of the academic understanding made it very simple to analyze. And idea came and lies, probably fastest paper I've written. That took hardly 3 weeks from the idea to the
final submission of the paper.
Yes, about 4 weeks I think maximum.
When was that cross finished?
So cross was finished in 59 early, or sorry, 58 middle, but it took 6-8 months to sort out the phasing problem.
Right.
We started making first maps in 60, early 60s, and I made maps till 63.
You were at Stanford for that?
Till after my PhD in late 60, I stayed on at Stanford for teaching. I was a student professor there.
Mm-hmm.
I had actually a job offer at Bahitian at NRAO. And first he asked me between scientists and engineers, because they had some problem. And I said I wanted to develop the interferometer, and Bahitian said there isn't the I don't know, you should not quote me.
I won't quote anything without your permission. Yeah.
So he said, well, but there isn't a east-west waistline there for the informative. But nevertheless, this part, I told him that I'm interested in building informatives. There was no informative program there.
Right.
And he wrote to me, well, he's not sure whether the informative program can be there. He made an offer with half time, and I was hesitant to accept it. So he wrote another letter that he has talked to Struve, and it's been decided to set up develop informative program, and he offered me to be a leader in the informative program at the Green Bank. I have a letter like that from Isham. That's in November 60 or something.
This is when Struve was still director.
That's right.
But Hishan was in charge of all the radio technology part of it. Yeah.
So they, showed to him what can be done and the importance. We had long discussions on this. So he finally wrote a letter that he offered me a job and asking me to be a leader in the informative program development at Green Bank. But by the time I decided I had to return to India. So I thought best is to stay over Stanford another year and a half. Because once I go to Green Bank, I'm committing myself 5-7 years, particularly if Hishan says, okay, he'll develop an informative program. And they talked to NSF, and NSF had indicated that they will fund stability.
Right.
So I did not go to Green Bank, stayed over at Stanford.
Now, why did you want to go to India?
Well, I thought I had been enough long time abroad.
I mean, but did you go back to wanting to do radio astronomy?
Yes.
Okay, this is continuing with Swarup on 18th August 76.
At the Berkeley meeting at IAU.
In 61,
several Indians, four of us, Kochi Menon, myself, Mukul Kundu, and T. Krishnan, who was in Australia, we met together and wrote a proposal. Said that we will like to come together to India as a group if some laboratories, some institute is willing to offer us opportunity. And we sent copies of this to many organizations. And Dr. Bhabha, who is director of Tata Institute and chairman of Atomic Energy Commission, he very promptly offered us jobs.
I see. How do you spell his name?
B-H-A.
Okay.
B for boy.
Right, Bhabha.
Bhabha. So he's one of our, he died in plane crash, 66. He was one of our great scientists. And atomic energy program in India is entirely due to him. So he promptly offered. And he said, well, the sky's the limit. Essentially, that's what he said. There's a very interesting it's a very interesting conversation that he had with Kochi Menon, who had met on our behalf while Bhabha was visiting Washington, D.C. And Kochi Menon said, well, he wonders whether Bhabha is talking out of his head.
Yeah, right.
That's what he wrote to me. But I knew Bhabha back in the days I was in India, National Physical Laboratories. I knew his credibility. And I had over years acquired how to do things. And you see, don't forget that you asked me why I decided to go back to India. Well, of course, you come from India and you grow up there.
Sure.
You have some kind of idealism. And some people have, not all.
Right.
And besides, the 50s were the era where one could all the time be thinking, oh, if you can build very simply large instruments of one kind or another. And there's a great new opening into radio astronomy.
Sure.
And so I grew up in that era, starting from Australia.
Right.
That I thought a neater way of bringing the large scopes, and I still think. You see, I've now recently been talking about what I call an international radio telescope at Neta Wavelength, utilizing this idea of parallel to the axis of the Earth, make something 5 to 10 times bigger than UT telescope, and but at the equator.
Yes.
Before the world gets too civilized to have interference at Neta Wavelength all over,
right.
One can be 0.1 millijanski in 10 hours time.
I see.
So I've already written a proposal, sent it to Brazilians where the equator passes.
Right.
And been talking to various people.
I see. And you've just been doing this right now, you're saying?
Yes, right. Yes, I've been. I mean, see, it's still a great scope for new discoveries and new. I think that.
Oh, yes.
So, the $80 million of VLA doesn't deter me because that's one way of doing things, but there are radio astronomy still open. Poles and wires. You see the 178 megahertz of a wild wind.
Right.
And just an example.
The low frequencies have been neglected, really.
So I knew how to do things, and right. That's a sort of motivation. So when Baba gave this offer, 63, I returned. And I had many plans. I had written many, many proposals for doing work, which is not being done in the United States. The people who told me, why don't you induce Baba to import a 25-meter dish? There's a great deal of work to be done, OH and H2 and so on. Including some very well-known astronomers who told me when I was asking, well, I'm going back to India, what do you suggest? Just like that.
Right.
And then I was all the time trying to see whether I have some advantage. And then I was reading the 3C273 paper.
Which one?
The 3C273 on quasar.
Oh, the one
Hazard's paper on occultation.
Right, right.
In the library, it's a new issue, sitting in the library TFR, I got the new issue.
Yeah.
And reading the 3C273, and I was really fascinated by the quality of the record.
Right.
And while sitting there, I started calculating how many occultations can 210 foot dish see in a year.
Right.
And I found that they can't see more than 10, 15, 20. So I thought, that's a opening. What about building a big meter wavelength telescope? Have 100 people, labor is cheap in India, have a large dipole array,
right.
Get them whole day moving around,
right, right.
Rotating the telescope. And pretty soon it was obvious that baseline stability is required. While sitting in the library, all this thought process went, and the whole, I had seen the parabolic cylinder being done by Italians. It looked very simple.
The Bologna cross.
Yes.
Yes.
They just constructed. I have, a few months before,
right.
I was passing through Italy.
Right.
And Bracewell and myself had written an article in 61 in Nature, Future Large Telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
And 55, when I was returning from Australia, with Yagis, I had intention of doing occultations in India with Yagi antennas.
Yeah.
So I was aware of the advantages of north-south baselines close to the equator. This is a little pieces of knowledge that I had over years.
Right.
Different diverse fields.
And it all sort of coalesced.
Suddenly coalesced together in that half an hour, and I went up, my room was next to who was a later director of the institute. At that time he was dean of the institute, Professor M.G.K. Menon.
Yeah.
So I went from the library very full of enthusiasm, so opened his door, see if he's there, and asked him, well, I've got a wonderful idea, but I think it's too costly. I don't think it's practical. He said, why do you think? I think it's not practical in India. It's too complicated. Well, if you think it's so good, why don't you sit down and write about it? I said, this is a good idea. You see, I'm not committing myself to
right.
So I sat down to write about it. And of course, as you write down, your ideas clarify. And
right.
You start talking to more people and they react. And so. Month later, it was written and showed to Baba one morning after 1 hour of discussion. He'd asked more questions than consulting engineers asked me in the next 6 months. As a physicist.
Yeah.
And he said, go ahead. And,
how much
then it took time, some 1.5 years to find people who to get designed, because in India is a great problem. Those days, hardly any design work was done in India.
Right.
It was a very expensive stage of our.
Now, which year is this you're talking about?
63.
63.
I was back in India in 63, actually.
Right.
And then, since you're not, what is still, I'll just complete this few sentences.
Yeah, sure.
So, 63, August it was. And, but it took 2 years just to probe around and find where to get things done and to get advertising, hire people, because everybody had to, I could not find anybody with experience.
Right.
Except a couple of people who had been France and Holland, very competent.
Right.
Joshi and Sharma. And so 65 end is when we started designing the telescope, and 69 end we finished the
Utilidad
telescope.
Now, what was the cost of the telescope, roughly?
The structural, mechanical, electrical foundation earthwork is only about about $400,000.
Hmm.
And at the exchange rate at that time.
Yeah.
And the total cost is of the order of $1 million.
The site and
yes,
the buildings and everything, yeah.
Including buildings and
right.
Roads and electronics and the entire setup, or designing costs. And, as you know, it is equivalent to about a 450 feet diameter. Or 500 feet down. The effective area is equivalent
right.
to about 450 diameter dish, steerable for 10 hours a day.
Right. Now, while you were reading this article in Nature, did it also come to you the idea of putting it on a hill?
Yes, yes, same time. That's north-south lines on the hill.
Right.
That if I can put a pair of... You see, because I started 10,000 dipoles, and then I could... because I knew I'm working in Farmator for 10 years, right from Australia, Brussels Cross,
right,
plotting maps of the sun. So I could draw almost at any latitude and north-south lines, how much they change.
Oh, yes.
I plotted maps of the sun from minus 4 hours to plus 4 hours. Nice. Manual computations.
Right.
All the computations I did for two-dimensional maps of the sun, two-dimensional Fourier transforms.
That's the advantage that we lose today when we do everything in the computer.
Yes, right. Right. So I was at that time multiple discipline man. So the idea of the slope occurred to me. That what I require is large, I want to mechanically steer it through the day. And so I just put it on flat ground to begin with, and then found that the change is too much. I went to, I knew how much moon moves because I didn't know, I never studied the moon, but I knew how the sun moves.
Right.
And that is sufficient because the moon follows almost the same path.
Right.
So I knew rate of movements, which I didn't have to calculate.
Right. Right.
So it was obvious that even if it's north-south, I have to change the phase as well as mechanical steering.
To follow in depth.
Yes.
Yeah.
And my electrical engineering knowledge told me that as soon as I change phase, the baseline won't be stable. So I suddenly inclined it.
Oh, yes.
And then I wondered whether I can find a hill slope same as the latitude of the station. After that, I happened to be traveling to Tokyo RC meeting. It was interesting. For example, Alan Maxwell said, oh, yeah, yeah, we heard ideas, very interesting idea, but Nature doesn't cooperate easily. But Nature does, I think.
And so, was there much trouble finding this hill?
Yes, there was some trouble. And I think I would have found a longer hill, we would have found money in India to make it longer. So we thought we have a unique...
So you're limited by the hill,
yes,
essentially.
Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah. And this is the longest hill we could find, up right in the mountains.
And this is certainly the most unique aspect of it, I would say, is this business slope of the hill.
Yes.
But what other aspects?
No, that is essentially the unique aspect of the telescope,
right,
which provides steerability for 10 hours.
Right.
I think it's an idea which, in my mind, should be exploited on a much grander scale. A $10 million telescope, meter wavelengths, where you work multiple frequency by changing the focal lines, steerable for 11 hours a day,
yeah,
plus minus 60
yeah
degrees declination. And you get 0.1 millijensk in 10 hours, you can do all sorts of fantastic things.
That's right.
And I will pursue in my next 5, 10 years what I can do. Maybe it will be reality next year. Suddenly Brazilians will say, okay, go ahead. But it may take time. But
yeah,
I think this idea will get exploited in future. I'm quite clear in my mind.
But your strategy, like you say, is necessarily to do things that don't cost much. Don't try to compete with the Americans,
yes, right,
or Cambridge.
Yes,
or,
yes, yes. You
or
see,
whatever.
I remember later, this Pauzy wrote to me, while... I think I have, Pauzy probably partly the cause for my inspiration to go back to India. And I'll write to him some other letter and some little sentences, ah, what are your plans? He had a great, what I might call, friendship or, he had love for India. Not love is not the right word.
Right.
He had a warmth for India.
Yeah.
And he felt, there are great things which can be done.
So he encouraged you to
go. Yes, all the
back
time. Any letters, any time we meet. And he also once, I think, wrote to me, provided you do things which are not fashionable.
I see.
Yes. It's very clear letter from him. And he says, well, great opportunity. But several of us as Indians, we form a complementary team.
Right.
We have no doubt we'll do well. And this sort of thing helps, you know, when he
has yes
this room.
Well, thank you very much.
That ends the interview with Swarup on 18th August, 76. This is the end of this side of the table.